The zeitgeist of the 90s, I think, is still being written.
Set it and forget it.
There's this new fascinating technology that everybody's getting into.
Task bars and email and shortcuts, oh my.
You know, it was a great time.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and today we're talking with W. Joseph Campbell. He's a professor of journalism at American University and the author most recently of the brilliant new book, 1995, The Year the Future Began. Professor Campbell, thanks for talking.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
You talk about 1995, 20 years ago, as a clear starting point for contemporary life, a hinge moment, and the first year of the 21st century. What do you mean by that?
The Netscape IPO of August of 1995 was a moment that really illuminated the web for a lot of people. Netscape, of course, made a fantastic browser, and it was a very popular browser. And the company had only been in existence for less than 2 years, a year and a half, when it had this IPO, its initial public offering of its shares. And the shares were incredibly important and valuable. And Netscape showed that a lot of people could make money, or some people could make money on the internet. But more important, it illuminated, as I say, the web for a lot of people who weren't familiar with it and weren't aware of it.
Yeah, and it seems so long ago because Netscape's fortunes, we might as well be talking about AMP or something, right? Or Sears Roebuck.
Exactly. It was even the trajectory of Netscape was even briefer than that. It was like from 1994 to 1999. So it really was meteoric.
And then
emerged, became a terrific property. It was a terrific company. And embraced a lot of the swagger and potential. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you talk about it really, Mark Andreessen, one of the co-founders of Netscape. If Jim Morrison was the ultimate rock star, the first real rock star, Andreessen was kind of the first web star.
Exactly, and I wish I had said that for the book. That's a good line, it happens to be accurate too. He really was, and he was only in his early 20s, just out of college, a couple years out of college, when he founded Netscape, co-founded Netscape, and he and his partners recruited some of his buddies from the University of Illinois, where he had developed a browser before going to California to start up Netscape. And these guys made a new browser that was wildly popular.
These guys were somewhat drenched in history. I mean, they were coming out of a tradition, but it was mostly that they were young, they were looking forward, and they weren't going to play by the old rules.
In many respects, that's true. In many respects, that's very true. And they were kind of setting their own rules, and the internet allowed people to do that because nobody knew what this was going to look like. In fact, up until the mid-90s, really, they thought the internet would be a component, a sub-element, really, of a broader information superhighway.
There was also in the mid-90s, I mean, people are afraid of change, and the web becoming kind of commercialized and a mass medium. People freaked out, and Congress in 1996 ended up passing the Communications Decency Act as part of a telecom act, which would have regulated the internet effectively like a broadcast network. What happened that did not take place?
Well, that piece of legislation, the Communications Decency Act, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, and I believe it was a unanimous decision, but it was overwhelmingly unconstitutional, recognized as such. But it was an early attempt by Congress to sort of begin to grapple with the potential, the deleterious potential of the web, of the new technology, and a lot of people thought this was going to be just a cesspool of pornography and nothing redeeming about it at all. In fact, some of the congressmen and senators who were behind the Communications Decency Act had very little firsthand familiarity with what they were trying to regulate.
Wait, you're telling. That's shocking, right?
It is.
That they have no idea of what they're talking about.
You have to read it or pass it to understand what's in it. But it was a real shocking attempt to regulate this emergent technology, and it probably would have strangled it in its infancy. But it was also an attempt, also a moment in which a lot of people who were advocates of the web, vigorously opposed these measures and ultimately prevailed.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the other events that you talk about, the Oklahoma City bombing. How did that exemplify kind of the end of an old order and the beginning of the contemporary moment?
It really did, and it was a shocking attack deep in the American heartland, an attack without warning. And interestingly, the initial reaction to the bombing was that it had to have been Middle East terrorists. Mm-hmm. And the news media really went hard on that angle, so did the FBI. But it turned out to be an act of domestic terrorism with a very small band of disgruntled Army veterans.
Right. And basically, Timothy McVeigh. I mean, McVeigh pretty much is the only person who was directly involved, and then he had a couple of associates.
That's right. Terry Nichols was helping him and helped him put together the bomb that was the truck bomb. That he delivered outside the Oklahoma City Federal Building. And then there was a third sort of co-conspirator, who Michael Fortier was his name, who knew about but didn't say anything to
Thorpe.
To
but he didn't know exactly when it was going to happen, et cetera.
That's right. He knew where, though, McVeigh had targeted.
So this is, I mean, in a similar way, if part of the emergence of the World Wide Web was the idea that a couple of individuals coming out of nowhere could massively transform the world in a positive way, the Oklahoma City bombing then is kind of the dark inversion of that.
You can look at it that way for sure, mm-hmm. absolutely. And in the immediate aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing, the U.S. government began to put in place measures and restrictions on American life that have only become since then more apparent, more onerous, if you will, and even more accepted, I think, by many Americans. But some of the initial measures that were put in place included the blocking off of two blocks of Pennsylvania Avenue nearest the White House to thwart the potential attack on the White House by a truck bomb, a la Oklahoma City.
Right.
And that was done without any forewarning, without any much debate at all. It was essentially a Secret Service directive to protect the president from a potential attack. And that effort to prevent or to guard against the prospect of terrorist attacks has become more and more apparent over the years, and certainly accelerated after 9/11.
And it's interesting that the Oklahoma City bombing, much more than the first attack on the World Trade Center, which was 93, I guess, that the Oklahoma City bombing had such an effect, because in fact after the World Trade Center bombing, there wasn't really that much of an official response.
There was some, but it wasn't the intense and prolonged response that we saw in the Oklahoma City aftermath, that's for sure. Because the Oklahoma City bombing had the effect of rejuvenating some federal legislation that had really gone dormant on anti-terror efforts. And some of these measures were very draconian and would allow for the deportation, for example, of non-U.S. citizens on the flimsiest of evidence. And so some of this reaction was really intense. And you're right, we did not see that in the aftermath of the first World Trade Center bombing.
And then one of the other major spectacles that you talk about is the O.J. trial, the O.J. Simpson trial. How does that inaugurate the world that we're living in?
Well, you know, it was a spectacle, and it spread kind of like a stain across the year. It began in January of 1995 and ended with Simpson's acquittal on the two murder charges in October of 1995. And a lasting effect was to introduce to the mainstream consciousness the potential and value of DNA evidence, forensic DNA evidence. And this was a key part of the trial. The prosecution's case against O.J. was that they had no murder weapon, they had no confession, they had no witnesses, but they did have what they call a mountain of blood evidence, i.e. DNA evidence, that clearly pointed to O.J. Simpson's guilt. The defense's strategy was not to challenge the validity of the DNA evidence, of the science behind the DNA, but actually to challenge the way it was handled, processed, analyzed, and so forth in the laboratory, as well as being collected at the scene. And they were able to demonstrate just how poorly it was done at all of those levels, impugning this evidence that made, in my view, O.J. Simpson's acquittal inevitable.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187.
Orenthal James Simpson, not guilty of the crime of murder.
Which is also fascinating that we enter into this phase of where science, kind of super science, is going to finally clear up all the obfuscations of the universe. And at the very moment that we're learning about how perfect DNA evidence is, we learn that there's a human factor that renders it unusable or inoperable. That's a bizarre kind of irony.
It is. It's an intriguing point. It also had the effect of stimulating efforts and attempts and methodologies to collect this evidence in a proper way,
right,
so that it could be properly analyzed and properly presented in court. So it cleaned up really the efforts to collect and process this evidence.
What do you see as the OJ trial and the coverage of it? What is its legacy to the news media? Obviously, it helped mainstream the 24/7 news cycle.
In a way, it did. The case was though so unique and so unlike most murder trials that it's hard to draw a lot of parallels and generalize from this case. But nonetheless, it does remain the standard against which other high-profile, prominent murder trials are assessed and inevitably found wanting. If you think back over the past 20 years, there are many murder trials that have been likened to the OJ trial, but really weren't in terms of the duration, in terms of the sustained media interest, and in terms of the controversies, too. I mean, none of them really have captured those elements that so define the OJ trial.
What do you make of the racial dynamics of the OJ trial, too? Because the 90s was also an era where it seemed that old racial categories were kind of being exhausted. OJ himself was considered an honorary white person. Tiger Woods emerged as a multi-ethnic Kaplan Asian. And you talk about it in the book that the reaction to the verdict was split almost completely down racial lines.
That's right. There are a number of reasons for those reactions, and one of the reasons why it was so vivid and so widely noted was that the verdict was announced at a set hour. Judge Lance Ito, the judge who presided over the trial in Los Angeles, said that the verdict is in, but we're going to announce it tomorrow at 10 o'clock Pacific time. So everybody knew in the country really was sort of, the New York Times called it an eerie moment of national communion. The country shut down in anticipation of the OJ verdicts, not guilty, guilty. And a lot of people were just gathered around television sets and radio sets to know the verdict. Not knowing was like an impossibility. You just didn't want to know.
And again, it's a weird bookend to the real publicity splash of the low speed chase, which kind of inaugurated the media coverage during the NBA finals when another vast television audience was in place.
Absolutely. And I think the audience in October of 1995 was even greater.
Oh, I'm sure.
And it was probably unlike any moment in American history, except perhaps for the first lunar landing.
Right. I mean,
everybody knew when it was going to happen, but nobody knew what the outcome was going to be. And the country, as I say, shut down. People wouldn't get on airlines. Yeah. They wouldn't get on flights until they knew the verdict. The telephone call volume dropped off dramatically. And so the Simpson verdict was widely anticipated. But I think some of the important elements of the reaction and how that was interpreted was probably misinterpreted by the news media as a black-white kind of divide. Not all whites thought Simpson was guilty, and not all blacks thought he was not guilty. So there was that element that was not well captured by the news media. And at the same time, Colin Powell was out with a memoir, was doing a book tour, and was called the most popular American of any color,
right,
by one columnist. So Colin Powell was there, and he was thinking about a presidential election, a run for president in 1996, the following year. So you had OJ on one hand, the reaction seemed to be suggesting there was this national divide along the racial lines, and then you had Colin Powell on the other, who everybody, you know, black and white, were sort of coalescing around. So which is it?
And then we had Bill Clinton as the first black president,
right,
too. So, I mean, it's an interesting, definitely a hinge moment.
It was. And Clinton was very worried about the prospect of Colin Powell mounting a campaign against him. Colin Powell eventually decided in November 1995 that he wasn't going to run for president. He didn't hear the calling, he said.
Let's talk about another political event that takes up a chunk of the book, the Dayton Peace Accords. And you talk about, you use Peter Beinart's term about the hubris bubble. What did the Dayton Peace Accords, what did they signal in American culture?
Well, this was a moment when American diplomacy muscular American diplomacy brought an end to the worst conflict in Europe since the time of the Nazis, since the end of World War II. And that's the war in Bosnia, which 100,000 people or so were killed in this conflict, this 2.5-year, 3-year conflict. One that the European powers couldn't resolve, despite many efforts to try. The United States, through the good services of and the talents of Richard Holbrooke, who then was an assistant secretary of state, brought the representatives of the three countries involved, Bosnia, Serbia, and Croatia, the heads of state, essentially, the presidents, to Dayton, Ohio, to the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and kept them there essentially for 3 weeks in radio silence until they thrashed out an agreement that ended this long war in Bosnia. And that was the first clear major success, foreign policy success, of the Clinton administration. And it really did give the administration a lift. It really boosted the administration's ability to feel good about itself, to bring about a successful conclusion to authority and, foreign
and
policy.
And this was at a time where the people were talking about the incredible shrinking presidency and Bill Clinton after he had lost Congress, control of Congress in the 94 election. So he was kind of evaporating, and this helped bring him back.
That's right. It really did. That and the government shutdown of mid-November 1995, which Clinton outmaneuvered, essentially, Newt Gingrich and the House Republicans, and sort of came out on top. At least public opinion polls suggest that Clinton got the better of that shutdown. So that happened in mid-November 1995. In the third week of November, there's the Dayton Peace Accords. The accords are initialed at Dayton, signed in Paris amid great pomp and circumstance. Now, Clinton did agree to send 20,000 U.S. troops as part of a larger peacekeeping force, a NATO peacekeeping force, to Bosnia, which was a very politically risky decision. It turned out well because no American casualties were
But then you talk about it too as the hubris bubble. I mean, this is kind of what inflated the hubris bubble, right? That the legacy then is that, okay, well, we're America. And you talk about how Clinton didn't quite use the term American exceptionalism, but he brought it back in vogue that, all we have to do is come in and start making people talk, and we can fix any problem in any country anywhere.
Essentially, and without us, it's not going to work. It's not going to happen. Without us, peace in Bosnia is not going to last. Without our presence of troops there, it's not going to happen. So this notion of American exceptionalism, you're right, he didn't call it that, but that's exactly what he was referring to, really took hold, and it undergirded this sense of hubris, this hubris bubble that began expanding in the aftermath of Dayton. And it was accompanied by a muscular approach to foreign policy, a willingness to use force to achieve foreign policy ends. And we saw this in Iraq in 1998, when Clinton ordered the bombing of Iraq to supposedly degrade Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction arsenal. We also saw it in the Kosovar War of 1999, and we certainly saw it in the aftermath of 9/11 with the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan, and then in Iraq starting in 2003. So this hubris bubble kept expanding until it did burst in the insurgency that the United States was totally unprepared for in the aftermath of the invasion of Iraq.
One of the other, and this is the last long section in the book, which also deals with, among other things that happened in 1998, but it started in 95, Clinton meets Lewinsky. Talk about, obviously they met in 95. What is the enduring legacy of that whole story?
I think that legacy is still being written. I think part of the legacy is the sharp political cleavage that we see in the country today in terms of the partisanship, Democrat, Republican, left and right. And it's a mistake to say it was only because of the impeachment wars of 1998, 1999 that we have this political division today. But it certainly was a contributing factor. The impeachment votes, the votes to impeach President Clinton in December 1998 were clearly along party lines. The two counts that Congress approved, that the House approved, most Republicans favored, most Democrats opposed. And same with the votes to convict or acquit him in the Senate in February 1999. Most Republicans voted to convict him, and most Democrats voted against him. It had no chance ever of getting to the two-thirds level that was needed. But what's intriguing about 1995 in this whole scandal was, if it were not for the government shutdown of mid-November 1995, Clinton and Lewinsky would have never had an opportunity to get close. She was a nominal White House intern at the time, and because of the shutdown, the partial government shutdown, most White House staffers, as well as most federal employees, were sent home or stayed home. They were furloughed. And into this breach at the White House entered the cadre of interns who filled the jobs of answering the phones right. and doing whatever has to be done to keep the place functioning. Lewinsky.
And yeah, you even mentioned in the book that she, Lewinsky, believed that Clinton's actual White House girlfriend had been furloughed.
Yes, that's so right. That's right. She was under the impression that he had another girlfriend, right. and she was like a temporary fill-in during right. the furlough. Her assignment was in the Chief of Staff's office, which is down a corridor from the Oval Office. Had it not been for that shutdown, she would never have had the opportunity.
Do you
to get
think
close.
You know? People talk about the you know, and I can remember when Clinton took office. People were like, "Oh well, he's not taking the office of president seriously." And there was a whole flap about like his weak military salute to people and things like that.
Exactly.
And,
yep.
But you know, and then the Lewinsky incident really, you know, changed the picture of the president. I mean, everybody knows that presidents have, you know, behaved poorly in their personal lives, but this was inescapable and it was on TV. And is that part of its legacy that it's, you know, in many of the things you're talking about here, authority, kind of established authority has taken it on the chin in many of the events that you talk about in 95. Is that part of the legacy of Clinton meeting Lewinsky?
It could be. I think another element of the legacy is that it's very difficult to impeach a president, and we're not going to be doing this again for the kind of misconduct that Clinton was guilty of. I mean, he clearly perjured himself in a federal deposition and probably committed obstruction of justice, too, which are akin to the crimes that Richard Nixon was forced out of office for. I mean, he really obstructed justice in the Watergate scandal, but that was an order of magnitude, it seems, more serious than what Clinton was
and of course, he resigned before he was going to face all of that.
That's
too,
right.
Which is part of the fascinating lesson of Clinton is that, you know, just stick it out. I mean, like, if you can outlast your enemies, you know, you can hang on no matter what.
True enough. And he had the good fortune, Clinton, of having enemies who were so bungling and so inept. They in effect, became his allies. I mean, it's a succession. I mean, he ran against George H.W. Bush in 1992 for the presidency. Bush by then was kind of out of touch and perceived widely as such. In 1996 for re-election, Clinton ran against Bob Dole, who was like 73 years old and not the most vigorous Republican
who had pledged to only serve one term.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then Kenneth Starr, who was the independent counsel who investigated Clinton's misconduct, also was sort of tone deaf and didn't really understand, didn't have the political skills or the wiliness of Clinton, and was clearly outmaneuvered by him.
Is the real legacy of the Clinton presidency is just keep doing what you're doing.
If you have the skills to be able to maneuver that way, I think so. And I'm not sure Obama is quite as politically skilled as Bill Clinton. I mean, he is, you're right, plowing ahead, and his popularity seems to be rising a bit. But we're talking about Clinton in the 60s. Approval rating, 60%
right.
approval rating in the, late in his second term, and we don't see that at all with Obama.
When will we know that the 90s have ended?
We need a little bit of critical distance to make that determination. It could have been that it ended with 2001. Some people make the argument that the 90s began, I don't necessarily subscribe to this, but it's an intriguing case, that the 90s began with the fall of the Berlin Wall mm-hmm. in 1989, signaling the end of communism in Eastern Europe. And then the 90s continued until September 2001 with the terrorist attacks of that day. So that could be, you know, a way in which you're looking at the 1990s. But the 90s are so popular in some popular cultural kind of way that it seems like you hear often references to the 90s are back.
Right.
And the 90s are there's what 90s nostalgia that seems to be pretty strong. There's a strain of that.
What
very
explains
strong.
That in a way that, you know, I was thinking about as we're talking, the 1950s, particularly by conservatives in the 1980s, the 1950s became this decade when everything was great. You know, women stopped working, which was good for conservatives. Men, you know, people stopped getting divorced. The economy boomed. There were no problems. Kids were respectful of their elders. And yet, if you go back and look at the 1950s, you know, it's a decade of Catcher in the Rye, of The Wild One, of Rebel Without a Cause, of Why Johnny Absolutely. Can't Read, of Growing Up Absurd, of the Beatniks, and of absolute moral and mental and urban chaos. What decides, you know, and then other decades, like the 70s, also seen as generally negative, mm-hmm. but there was a lot of really fascinating stuff going on, both economically in terms of deregulation of airlines and railroads and right. trucking, as well as a lot of lifestyle experimentation, which people now would see as a good thing. You know, how what makes a decade be seen through rosy colored glasses or through very dark glasses?
That's a very good question. Again, with the passage of time, it helps explain that. But the zeitgeist of the 90s, I think, is still being written. You're right, the zeitgeist of the 50s was this placid time when everybody was sort of at peace and prosperity reigned. You have some of that, too, with the 1990s. Looking back, particularly the second half, that, you know, the country is largely at peace, the economy is booming, there's this new fascinating technology that everybody's getting into. You know, it was a great time. But there are other folks, Charles Krauthammer, for example, who calls the 1990s a holiday from history, mostly saying that to excoriate Clinton and his policy on terrorism, international terrorism. But still, I think holiday from history is probably an exaggeration too. It was not that simplistic, obviously. There were a lot of important major issues that we're still grappling with today. I mean, everything from foreign policy issues to you know, the rise of the internet.
Right. And I mean, we're going to be talking about net neutrality, which is 20 years later is another attempt by the government to regulate or constrain the internet according to its vision of what is fair and right.
Absolutely. So these attempts to label a decade tend inevitably to be simplistic, superficial, and misleading. And so I don't think the zeitgeist of the 90s is yet written, and it's certainly not a holiday from history. It certainly wasn't a time in which, you know, nothing much happened, and we were kind of like beginning to set ourselves up for the terrorist attacks of September 11th.
Well, we will leave it there. The book is 1995, The Year the Future Began. We've been talking to Joseph Campbell of American University. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.